You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Some say that health outcomes are not keeping pace with the costs of health care, while the system is by design more disease care than health care and prevention. What can be done about an entrenched health care system? Dr. Pamela Ross, a featured physician in the movie documentary Escape Fire: The Flight to Rescue American Healthcare, gives an inspiring take on lessons learned. Pamela Ross, MD, is an associate professor of emergency medicine and pediatrics at the University of Virginia Health System and founding CEO of Holistic Medical Consultants. She bases her holistic medical principles and practice on the belief that there is an unbreakable connection between the mind, body, and spirit. Ms. Ross spoke at the Wednesday, June 12, 2013 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV President Sue Liberman.
I have the privilege of introducing Dr. Pamela Ross to you, who is our speaker today. Dr. Ross is an associate professor of emergency medicine and pediatrics at the University of Virginia Health System and founding CEO of Holistic Medical Consultants. And bear with me, I really don't want to mess any of this up, because her background is really extremely impressive. So I'm going to read some of it. Dr. Ross bases her holistic medical principles and practice on the belief that there is an unbreakable connection between mind, body, and spirit. A native of rural Decatur, Tennessee, and her parents' oldest child, Dr. Ross's exceptional perceptive skills and mental capabilities were realized at a very early age. By the time she reached the fourth grade, she was engaged in various public speaking opportunities through the 4-H Club, the nation's largest youth development organization. Public speaking was a skill that came easily to Dr. Ross, which she mastered early on, but it was her mother's illness that sparked her real interest in and curiosity in the study of medicine. Determined to aid her mother, Dr. Ross focused her education and career and goals on becoming a physician. Dr. Ross received her BA in chemistry from the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga and her MD from Emory University School of Medicine. Her distinguished career is filled with notable highlights, including receiving an invitation from President Barack Obama to be present at the White House Rose Garden when he presented Doctors for Healthcare Reform to the nation, an event that galvanized the eventual passage of the Affordable Care Act by the United States Congress. Most recently, she's a featured doctor in Escape Fire, The Fight to Rescue American Healthcare, a 2012 Sundance premiere movie documentary that tackles the pressing issues of a badly broken healthcare system. Dr. Ross spends her spare time nurturing her own mental, physical, and spiritual well-being through reading, meditation, laughter, dance, and fellowship in various settings with family and friends. I'm not going to read you all the other accolades she has received. I think you'll sense that for yourself. So I get great pleasure in presenting Dr. Pamela Ross.
Thank you so very much, Sue, for that kind introduction. It is truly an honor to be here with you to receive this invitation to speak today to the senior statesmen of Virginia. I'm especially inspired by your mission, where seniors work to identify and articulate viewpoints on issues that affect all citizens of the Commonwealth of Virginia. James Baldwin, an American playwright, poet, and social critic, says this, and I agree. Children have never been very good at listening to their elders, but they have never failed to imitate them. And one of the best facilitators for improvement is communication. And as a practicing physician in this community, I'm delighted to be a part of any forum that provides a platform for people to come together and talk about how we can improve healthcare. It's going to take everyone, doctors and other healthcare providers, administrators, policymakers, and most important, patients, you, me, people, to come together and talk about it so that we can continue to formulate plans and solutions that will make healthcare better, not just for ourselves, but for our children. I applaud you on your wisdom in matters of healthcare, and I look forward to engaging you in continuous dialogue on healthcare. Now, who in the room has seen the movie documentary Escape Fire, The Fight to Rescue American Healthcare? Okay, very good. So the title, Escape Fire, is a metaphor for unconventional solutions to problems that are either so obvious or so counterintuitive that they're missed. So why would a person start to walk every day to help a heart condition if they're guaranteed the promise of a technology like a cardiac stent to treat that condition? Or why would a doctor change their practice to a point that they make less money? Or why would a healthcare administrator place emphasis on creating programs that motivate and create access for populations that are underserved? So just to kind of go into this metaphor, and for many of you who are not familiar with the documentary, I'm going to play a trailer from the documentary to give you a viewpoint of what we're talking about in the movie. And so before the trailer starts, I am one of the featured physicians in the movie, but in the trailer, you will only catch glimpses of me. Maybe my hand on a patient's chest listening with my stethoscope, or perhaps my ponytail as I turn the corner going to visit a patient. But if you want to see me in my full splendor in the movie, you're going to have to watch the entire movie. But it is a very worthwhile, thought-provoking documentary. It aired on CNN during the entire month of March. It is available on DVD, and I also have a copy that's available for public viewing if the Senior Center should ever have an interest in providing that as a service. But at this point in time, we'll take 5 minutes so that you can see the trailer to the documentary to give you an idea of what it's about and what we're speaking about, and then we'll pick up from there. Is that okay? All right, thank you.
In 1949, a forest fire broke out in Man Gulch, Montana. Smoke jumpers were parachuted in a team of 15 headed by a foreman named Wag Dodge. The fire exploded. It was moving over 600 feet a minute, faster than most people can ever run. And so 15 firefighters were trapped. Wag Dodge had an idea. He knew that they would lose the race back to the top of the ridge. So he suddenly stopped, he lit a match, and he lit a fire at his own feet. And the fire spread around him. I imagine the other smoke jumpers thought the guy was crazy. But his idea was this: if I burn the fuel around me, then when the fire comes and overtakes me, I'm safe. I'll be in what came to be known as an escape fire. He tried to get the other smoke jumpers to join him, and nobody did. The fire overtook the crew, killing 13 men and burning 3,200 acres. Wag Dodge survived, nearly unharmed, in his escape fire. It's just tragic to think of the answer being there, but just in the moment, not able to see it. That's how embedded people get in the status quo. They can't recognize an invention when it's among them, and they can't give up their old habits. We're in Man Gulch. Healthcare, it's headed for really, really bad trouble. The answer's among us. Can we please stop and think and make sense of the situation and get our way out of it? It's the same challenge.
Is how we're going to give more people access to the present system and how we're going to pay for it. And to me, that's not the only issue. The present system doesn't work, and it's going to take us down. We need a whole new kind of medicine.
Healthcare reform was a good place to start,
but it will do little to address the root problems.
We don't have a healthcare system in this country. We have a disease management system.
Often think it has to be a new drug or a new laser or something really high-tech and expensive to be powerful. And they have a hard time believing that these simple choices that we make in our lives each day can make such a powerful difference.
We're in the grip of a very big industry, and it doesn't want to stop making money.
At the executive level, what's most important is meeting Wall Street's expectations. And they have to. These for-profit companies, by law, have to serve shareholders. You almost forget that what you're doing is providing healthcare.
The healthcare system is unsustainable. We're spending almost twice as much in America as any other country on Earth. We're really mortgaging the future. Not just the health of healthcare, we're talking about the health of the nation.
So that's the trailer. Gives you a little background on what this is about. One of the key players in the documentary is a family practitioner named Dr. Erin Martin. And one of the things that is left out of the trailer comes from her as a primary care doctor who's very frustrated by the fact that she just does not have the time that she needs to spend with her patients. And she says that I can't get to the bottom of things. I'm being told I have to see more patients. And she speaks about how at the end of the day, how demoralizing that can be. But you hear her story, you'll hear patient stories, you'll see my perspectives as a doctor who works in the emergency department. And it's not designed to give you the answers, but it's certainly designed to facilitate more conversation. And trust me, your opinion matters, how you feel about healthcare matters, it makes all the difference. And it is important that we come together to talk about it continuously, because I think there's still work to be done. So first and foremost, I guess I should probably get to the pressing question and curiosities that you might have at this moment. How did they pick you to be in a documentary? Well, simply put, when life calls the tune, we dance. This journey to me being an award-winning documentary is not anything that I ever set out to do. So I don't really have any tips on leadership visions for Hollywood or movie making or imaging that I can provide. But I do want to share with you some leadership lessons that have been reinforced for me as a physician in my spirit consciousness on this journey since I began that decision to practice medicine. Now, as has already been stated, and perhaps you've read, I was 11 years old when I decided to become a doctor, and it was my childhood experiences of my mother's illness that led me to the noble profession of medicine. So at 11 years old, I decided I'm going to be a doctor, and I did everything in my power to make that happen. I studied hard. I graduated as valedictorian of my high school class. I went to college on a full academic scholarship, and I went right into medical school. And it was my experiences in medical school that led me to the specialty of emergency medicine. So that brings me to leadership lesson number one. Follow your gut and your dreams. The deep, deep, deep passion and compassion that we all carry within ourselves is something that we should all honor and allow it to take us wherever it may lead us. And there's nothing that creates stronger leadership than doing something that you really believe in. And when you're really doing the things that you believe in, then it stops feeling so much like work. And in the very painful but sacred path that led me to being asked to be a peer in an award-winning documentary, I have never, ever asked for permission to follow my instincts or follow my gut or follow my dreams, in spite of people who told me maybe that was unrealistic or maybe you should have second thoughts about this. And I've always lived my life believing that when I follow my gut, when I follow my instincts and I follow my dreams, I'm also very willing to accept the consequences and the rewards of those choices. Emergency medicine represents the healthcare safety net, and emergency medicine is the only specialty that's mandated by law to provide healthcare to people regardless of their ability to pay. Now, this makes me proud to do the work of employment that I do at the University of Virginia Health System, where I've been for the past 17 years, because I see the least of these. I see people who don't always have adequate access to primary care, who don't have adequate access to their medications, and who may not always fully understand their conditions because they haven't had the time to talk with their doctor to get a clear understanding of what's happening with them. I've seen a multitude of deaths that really come too soon from diseases and conditions that could have been prevented. And it really saddens me when I see when people are dying and they don't have to. And then I've seen deaths that occur appropriately, according to the agreement that the patient has between them and the Creator. And it's meant to be. It's natural. It's a part of the circle of life, only to meet the very emotional and passionate objections of loved ones who want everything to be done in spite of the futility of my efforts to save them. And this leads me to leadership lesson number two. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. While in my passion to do the things that I believe in, I've learned to respect that there is a skill that has to be developed when it comes to understanding this very crucial point. Now, when I first decided that I wanted to be a doctor, I actually thought I wanted to be a psychiatrist to help my mom. And it wasn't until medical school that it actually dawned on me. Now, I had heard the Serenity Prayer many, many times, but it didn't actually kind of take root into my heart until I got into medical school and had to come to terms with the fact that, you know what? My mother's condition may be something that is outside of my control. It may not be something that I would ever be able to fix. So I had to kind of regroup and figure out, okay, so what do I want to do as a doctor? And it was a series of rotations in medical school that helped me decide, well, emergency medicine, that's the specialty for me. You get to see a little bit of everything. And plus, because of my life experiences, I was very skilled at dealing with drama. So completing medical school was very exciting for me. I was the first person in my family to graduate with a medical degree. My great-grandmother had the opportunity to be present. She was in her 80s, and she cried. And my grandmother was present, and she cried. And it was just an exciting time. And I can remember changing the voicemail on my answering machine. That's when we had the machines. This is back in in the 80s. And I changed my message to tell the world, you've reached the voicemail of Dr. Pamela Ross. It was just a very exciting time. And from there, I moved right into residency. And then I did additional training in pediatrics after my residency. And from my training in Northern Virginia at Inova Hospital, I came to the University of Virginia, my very first job. So over this path, in general, I can promise you that most of the physicians that you meet want to be seen as excellent. They want to be seen at the top of their game in what they do. They want their patients to believe that they're really good, not only with their skills, but with their empathy and caring capabilities. And they want the hospital administrators to see them as valuable. Well, it was after engaging in the full practice of medicine for a few years that I started to actually note there were trends going on in healthcare that were making me uncomfortable. Patients were losing trust in us. They were accusing doctors of being non-caring, not spending enough time, not even touching them or looking at them, of only being concerned about money. Administrators were hounding us to cover our bottom line, that our revenue was falling and we were not doing enough. And I was quickly learning the wisdom of the difference between the things I could and could not control in healthcare. I learned that I was not really in control at all, but I'm a part of a very, very huge system that's nearly out of control. My frustration with what I observed to what was happening to the people that I would see in my practice and in the healthcare system and the decisions that were being made by health insurance companies and policymakers and administrators that put more distance between the doctors and the patients, it prompted me to study. I became very frustrated, actually. It prompted me. I'm like, what are they teaching these people? I went to medical school, so I hadn't learned all these business courses and things. I shed my blood, sweat, and tears just trying to get the anatomy and learn the nerves and get the medications right and the pharmacology, because my role would be important. I needed to teach people and save their lives. So never once did I take a business class, and never once did a class in economics come my way as a medical student. And that was okay with me, because at the time I was doing all I could do to learn all of this vast information that was the specialty of medicine. And wouldn't you know that 21 years later, about half of the stuff that I learned is no longer relevant. You know, we were back in the day, we learned, well, put your babies on their stomachs to sleep. And then somewhere along the line, it changed to put your babies on your back to sleep. That has happened in so many realms in healthcare that I can't keep up with it. And I was warned. My professors did say to us as medical students that you're here, and about half of the stuff you learn is going to be irrelevant in 10 to 20 years. We just don't know which half. So it led to, like, just the day-to-day practice of emergency medicine and medicine in general. Not just me, but lots of doctors were feeling like things were out of our control. Our patients are becoming sicker. They don't have good access to medical care. They're dying deaths that are preventable. They're suffering in ways that just seem unnecessary for the United States of America and the Commonwealth of Virginia. And this brings me to leadership lesson number 3. Never judge a designated leader until you've walked a mile in their shoes. With the advent of long-distance learning, I actually enrolled in the Executive Master's Program at UNC Chapel Hill to try to understand. I was serious. I'm not judging. I just want to know what you're being taught. What are you learning? And I want to learn it, too, because I want to be good for healthcare in every possible way that I can. So as a physician... I was dumbfounded, but I was really working to see what is this healthcare thing where I thought that physicians were the focal point. And that was a mistake for me to think that, because the whole system has completely dwarfed doctors, physicians. So it was in a healthcare marketing class that I got the answer, and it was a three-word answer that made my understanding crystal clear. And to think that I've spent several thousand dollars to learn this three-word answer: follow the money. Come with me. You saw the trailer to the documentary. So come with me on this exploration of healthcare for a dedicated and focused physician, and see how the paradigm has changed. We don't have a healthcare delivery system. We have a disease management system, and in many aspects that system operates for a profit. And so, you know, I've learned, you know, I've gotten out of medicine a little bit and learned some other things, and I know about investing, and I know that when investors invest in something, that something is supposed to make money. And when you own the share and you're making profits from, let's say, disease, then the investors who invest in entities that promote disease, like pharmaceutical companies, well, their goal is to serve the shareholders. Now, when I think about it, if you've got shareholders who are making money by the number of pills that you have to take that's supposedly to help you get better, what is the motivation to get you to a point where you don't have to take a whole bunch of pills? Because ultimately what happens in the system is that it wants that to happen, you know, for profit. When you follow the money, that's the goal, to make that happen, so that the system doesn't really want people to be completely cured, because if you're completely cured, you have no need of the system. It just wants you to keep coming back for the chronic conditions. And that's kind of one of the points that was brought out in the movie. And that brings me on to leadership lesson number four. The mantra, some people will say, no money, no mission. And I can earnestly say that should be completely reversed to no mission, no money. The profits should never be placed before people. And rest assured that when profits do fall, the people are still standing right there in need of everything that we have to offer. And I've never witnessed where serving to the heart of a very good mission has ever resulted in a lack of public interest or a willingness for the public to support the mission in some way. You have such an interesting story, Dr. Ross. Can we talk with you a little more? When the directors of the documentary asked me to share more of my time and story, the truth of my experience didn't feel very interesting, because I was struggling with the ideology of what it meant to practice medicine in America. And that leads me to lesson number five. I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happens to them all. That comes from one of my favorite books, the Bible, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 11. So you've heard about how President Barack Obama invited me to the White House. I can't say that there was anything special that I did or any particular knowledge that I had. I just received the invitation to give my thoughts about healthcare. I got the letter and I was thinking, yeah, right. But I figured it wouldn't hurt. So I wrote down my thoughts on healthcare reform, and the reply that I got was an email giving me instructions for Secret Service clearance to get into the White House Rose Garden. And that's when President Obama presented Doctors for Healthcare Reform. This was before the Affordable Care Act passed, and it was kind of a part of the momentum that actually got it passed into law. It's been challenged. It was upheld by the Supreme Court, and we still have yet to see exactly how it's going to roll out and exactly what it means for each of us. Now, later that same evening when I was in D.C., I was actually watching Larry King Live on TV, and he had Dr. Andrew Weil as a guest speaker talking about health care reform. Now, there's an interesting phenomena that happens. You know, you're walking around and you've got this vision or you've got this feeling, but you don't have the words, and then somebody comes along and they speak what you're thinking or what you're feeling. That's a very powerful thing, and that's exactly what Dr. Andrew Weil did for me. And when I heard him talking about healthcare and his ideals, I pulled out my laptop, I Googled him, and I found out more about him, and that led me to this next step. I wanted to be a part of the change that I desired to see in the world. And I enrolled in a long-distance fellowship program where I studied under Dr. Andrew Weil. And in 2011, I became a graduate of the University of Arizona's Fellowship in Integrative Medicine. Now, the basic tenets of integrative medicine are this, and it can be captured in a very, very short history of the world and of medicine. So think back. I want you to, like, create this maybe 3,000 or 4,000-year timeline about how doctors help people or how healers helped people. So several thousand years ago, it started like this. Here, eat this root. And then that changed to, that root is heathen. Say this prayer. And then that changed to, that prayer is superstition. Here, drink this potion. And then that transformed to, that potion is snake oil. Here, swallow this tablet. And then once again, it changed again to, that tablet is ineffective. You need this antibiotic. And then finally, it's come to, that antibiotic, it's artificial and it's toxic. Here, eat this root. Now, I would describe integrative medicine as this, back to the future. The focus is on reuniting physicians with patients and reconnecting us with why most of us went into medicine in the first place. In a little more detail, this is what can be emphasized. The doctor and patient are partners in a healing process. It's not the doctor being paternalistic and telling you what you have to do or telling you what's best for you. It's the doctor listening to you and working with you to formulate the best options for your own healing and for your own sense of well-being. It emphasizes broad concepts of promoting health and preventing illness as well as treating disease. They're all very important. It talks more about health care versus disease care, but it works to prevent and treat disease when it's present. It acknowledges and it honors the body's innate healing response. One of the most interesting things was when I learned anatomy in medical school, how remarkable the human body is, and how even after 21 years of study, we are still discovering reactions and connections and all types of things that relate to the human body that we did not know. And I expect that children who become doctors after me will be learning things about the human body that I haven't learned. It gives consideration to all factors that influence health, your mind, your body, your spirit, your community, your family, everything. It doesn't reduce you to a heart or an arm or a leg or a rash. It looks at you as an entire human being. It's a philosophy that doesn't reject conventional medicine. It doesn't reject. I'm not rejecting what I learned in medical school. I'm not rejecting what I do in the practice of medicine. And it doesn't uncritically accept complementary and alternative methods, which we find are very useful for patients. But it looks for the evidence-based balance between those two things. It asserts that the best practice of medicine is based in good science, it's inquiry-driven, and it should be open to new paradigms. Our research should be based on the questions that come before us, based on the people that we see, not necessarily to the highest bidder or the person with the most money to study something that may not be very helpful at a particular time. Doctors and healthcare practitioners are supposed to be models of health and healing, and we're supposed to be committed to the process of self-exploration and personal development. So technically, in my opinion, integrative medicine should be the standard for healthcare, and we can just drop the integrative term and call it the practice of medicine, period. It's been mentioned that 75% of healthcare costs go to diseases that are preventable. And the top five killers of Americans are these: diabetes, lung diseases, stroke, cancers, and heart disease. Now, we understand that not every type of cancer is preventable, same with heart disease and diabetes, but what we're finding is that a great deal or a portion of healthcare costs are going to those types of cancers, diabetes, heart disease, that are preventable. And that leads me to a brief discussion on leadership lesson number 6. It's about salubrity, and that should be a crucial element in healthcare. Now, salubrity is a Latin word. It has Latin roots, and it means promoting health or helpful. And it emphasizes taking responsibility for ourselves, our health in particular, so that we don't become an excessive burden on our families, on society. We take responsibility for our health. And we know that we've got history that shows that societies that are invested in the economic development, there's always an emphasis on the opportunity and the programs that allow people to stay healthy. They have the space, they have the time, they have the support to be healthy. It emphasizes the fact that we are to value our bodies and that, you know, we have lots of possessions. I know people get really excited about shoes or purses or cars or jewelry or other personal possessions. But ultimately, if we can learn to cherish physical things, we should also learn to cherish our bodies and create habits that preserve our bodies. And that leads me to leadership lesson number 7. I just have 2 more to go. When you discover that you might be part of an operation or something that's gone wrong, you've got to accept your errors, and you have to understand that it's okay to change direction and speak up. Groupthink is based in fear, and fear is a mind killer. Groupthink is a psychological phenomenon that occurs when a group of people want to fit in so badly that it results in incorrect or deviant decision-making behavior. When people sometimes just want to fit in so badly, they don't want to lose their position, they don't, whatever the fear may be, it can result in them working to minimize the conflict, to isolate themselves from influences that could get them to the right answer, and to reach group decisions that lack critical consideration of outside opinions. Groupthink is based in fear. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye and see its path. And where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. This is known as the Bene Gesserit Litany Against Fear and was written by a guy named Frank Herbert in a science fiction book called Dune. And then there's a parallel again from my favorite book, the Bible, that says, God has not given me a spirit of fear, but of love, power, and a sound mind. So on the last day of the fellowship, the directors approached me and they said, you know, you have a really interesting story. Do you think it would be possible for us to come to Charlottesville and film you at home and at work? And at the time, I really didn't know the answer because I hadn't come out of the closet about, you know, going into and studying and learning more about integrative medicine. But I turned them over to the PR department at UVA, and they made arrangements for them to come in and film in the emergency department. And then I just kind of forgot about it. I signed off on all kinds of forms that said, you know, if we use you in a movie, you earn nothing, you get nothing, you know, we just use you in the documentary. So, and I figured, yeah, they did all of this, but I'll probably end up on the cutting floor. But then in late 2011, I got a call from the directors telling me that the movie had been picked up for the Sundance Film Festival and was going to be premiering as one of the featured documentary films at Sundance. And from there, it has just really, really grown. And CNN picked it up, like I said, and aired it throughout the month of March. So that leads me to my final leadership lesson, number 8. Keep your big ego in check. So I had a movie documentary that, you know, was featured at Sundance, and of course I wanted to be there, and of course I had to ask my professional football playing friend, could you come and just pretend to be my bodyguard? And then I just found myself getting really out of control, just ego completely tied up into this thing. And I can only imagine. I joke with people saying, you know, it's really, I'm lucky. Not to say that the movie was not good, but I am just so lucky that it didn't get nominated for an Oscar. Can you imagine how I would have behaved? Oh, thank goodness I was spared of that challenge. But keep your big ego in check. In my humble opinion, the optimum leader is one who seeks to be of service to those that they wish to lead. And in order to accomplish this, the ego has to be suspended or seen for what it really is. It's an illusion of our higher selves. And when we deal with that big ego, we have to always be the central focus in order to have self-worth. In order to serve with compassion, I have to suspend my ego. I have to suspend the need for acknowledgement and accolades. If my ego is the primary construct in the persona of myself or any leader, then the satisfaction depends on possessions and praise and profits and the constant admiration and supplication of others. If a leader believes that they're only the sum of what they possess, then they lose sight of the true nature of leadership. So keep your big ego in check. When you change the way that you look at the world that you see will change, and I have to constantly practice humility, keep truth tellers in my life, and always be a learner. Children have been very good at listening to their elders. They've never been very good at listening to their elders. I'm sorry. Children have not been very good at listening to their elders, but they've never failed to imitate them. When it comes to a crunch, we actually look to you to see what we should do and how we should move forward. So I would like to express to you my deepest, sincerest gratitude to the senior statesmen of Virginia for the leadership, for the wisdom, for the insight that you bring to educate people on issues that really matter. And I really appreciate the invitation, and I look forward to talking with you more about your opinions and perspectives on healthcare. Thank you.
We have Bill Davis and John McCauley with microphones, and I invite all of you who have questions for Dr. Ross, put up your hand. And just a reminder that we podcast our programs, so you must speak into the microphone. Okay, who's got the first question?
Thank you. That was an excellent presentation. And I'm in full agreement. I don't think this thing works. In full agreement with what you are saying. I'm also in favor of the Affordable Care Act. However, do you think that in view of the fact that our society, as you mentioned, is money-oriented, will you and your fellow physicians be given the time that is necessary to actually interact with a patient as you feel you want to and you should? Or will you still be told that you've got 5 minutes per patient and you need so and so many patients per day that you see? Do you hope that you will be able to practice medicine more effectively and in the long run more profitably than we now do?
That's a very outstanding question, and I can say that it is my earnest hope. When I have to sit down and talk with my congressman, when I have to sit down and talk with my administrators, I'm very mindful of what are the things that help doctors get back to what their patients need to do. And I'll use an example from one of my colleagues who was also in the documentary, Dr. Erin Martin, who is a family practitioner. And after she, you will see this in the documentary, but she changed jobs like 3 different times trying to find that system that would allow her the time to sit down and talk with her patients. And she never found it. So what Dr. Martin did was she opened her own practice. Now this is, it's kind of moving in a direction that's different. What we've been seeing for the past several years is the private little doctor's offices are being purchased by bigger entities and they're becoming a part of the bigger entity. I feel like when the system is stressed or when the people make the demands, again, follow the money, when the people start to make the demands, then and doctors are given the opportunity to be in private practice, then that's what you'll see happening. When they're given the opportunity and given the space and given the freedom to do that, that's exactly what they want to do. You know, the other side of that is medical school. It costs a lot of doctors, a lot of money for doctors to be educated. I know that I came out of school with about $150,000 of debt. That's about an average debt for any person who has to borrow money to go to medical school. That's a great portion of the physicians. So I think we need to even look even further down the pipeline, perhaps like a comparable system, let's say like France. Those doctors pay nothing to go to medical school. They don't make half of what we make in the United States, but they don't pay to go to medical school, so they don't have that debt to cover, and they don't have to pay billing agents and insurance people to work to pull money from insurance companies. They've got a different type of system. So I would encourage that we continue to look at things like that, because I am hopeful that the doctor-patient relationship will be restored.
Well, my question actually is a bit related to the previous one. How do you foresee the changes occurring from Affordable Care Act to precisely UVA emergency delivery system?
That's a very good question, and I've just got my fingers crossed, because I'm not exactly sure how it's going to roll out. We've got the legislature that's still making decisions about exactly what we're going to do. We've got to implement things in the system. I consider myself the bottom of the decision-making totem pole. I'm one of the practicing doctors, so I have no say in the decisions as to how things will be rolled out. I think that what I'm bracing myself for is a season of maybe some confusion. This is brand new. This is a whole new thing that we're doing with healthcare. We don't know where Virginia will be with that. I've got a meeting with some policymakers on the Affordable Care Act next week to talk a little bit more about what we can expect. But right now, my goal is to stay open, to speak when I have something very important to say, to make the concerns known and to make sure that people are aware of what this is doing to our patients, whether it's hurting, whether it's helping, and what types of things we can do to make it better. It's a constant process. It's ever evolving.
You mentioned France. I think the World Health Organization gave them the award a couple of years ago for the best healthcare system in the world at that time. So, Escape Fire is a shorthand way of saying think outside the box. And if anybody wants to read more about the Man Gulch Fire, get Norman McLean's book, Young Men in Fire. He's the same guy that wrote A River Runs Through It. But it's not a new book. It's short. It's only about 100 pages. My topic concerns medical advertising on television, etc. I think it's a genie that was let out of the box about 15 years ago when Congress deregulated the broadcasting industry. Until then, as we all remember at our age, there was no such thing. No drugs, no doctors, no hospitals, no lawyers in broadcasting. Zip. And now it's everywhere. And my sister, who lived in the UK for 20 years, when she moved back here, she went, What is this? What is this stuff on the air all the time? What, you know, in the old days it was Band-Aids and aspirin, and now it's everything. And you, as doctors, should not have to put up with, doctor, they said on TV I should have this. Can I have this? Is this good for me? Ask your doctor if placebo is right for you. I want that genie put back in the box, and I don't know how to do it. Maybe you have an inside track.
I was hoping you would have an inside track. That's absolutely true. We talk about, the ratings of different healthcare systems in developed countries. We know that in the United States, we're spending almost $8,000 per person on healthcare. That's almost double more than any other country in the world, any other developed country in the world. And our outcomes are just not twice as good. We're spending twice the money, but our outcomes are not nearly twice as good. The United States is only one of two countries that allows for drug company advertising to the lay public. It is not common practice. Again, I suspect that this is about policy. This is about what happens when people take the vote. And that takes us into another realm of congressional lobbying. When a pharmaceutical company has profits that are in the billions, then they've probably got a little spare change where they can pay someone full time to be on Capitol Hill making donations and having discussions with the policymakers who make this decision. There needs to be an up, that whole system needs to change. And I think there's a documentary where Senator Warner is featured in this documentary where they're speaking about that very topic, about how lobbying has just changed everything. So, you know, we got to pharmaceutical broadcasting because some congressional committee said that it was okay to do, and that ended up being changed into a policy or law, and you see it everywhere. And it does not help. It does not improve outcomes. It results in people asking for things. And do you ever notice in those commercials how you've got the pretty pictures, you know, the person reclined in the tub or in the boat, but if you're listening, the script has said it can cause blindness, heart attack, death, da 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 da, and all these terrible things, but you're not listening, you know. You're buying into the imagery and the beauty of it, and you're like, I want that drug. And so we really need to resist the media. And when you have your meetings like this, and when you're talking with your policymakers and decision makers, ask the question again: what are they doing to stop this? Because this is something that needs to be stopped.
Dr. Ross, I've been associated with the University of Virginia Medical Center since 1980, and I've seen quite a transition since they at that time didn't acknowledge acupuncture or meditation or anything. In the recent years, there's been quite a bit of effort. And would you elaborate on what the active programs are for bringing the alternative, the complementary medicines of acupuncture, meditation, touch for health, any of these into actual practice so that there can be more of this. Talking to the medical students about death and dying, which was a taboo subject several years ago.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, change comes slowly, but it comes. And one of the School of Medicine, I think the school that is probably most established in this realm would be the School of Nursing, because they have the Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. So for the past several years, they have been doing all manner of research on complementary and alternative methods. Subsequently, that has come forward. We have the Department of Mindfulness. We have mindfulness and meditation practices. We have a whole department there that is designed to work with patients and physicians on matters of meditation. Now, this is chosen because it is clearly tied to the evidence that says that it can do things like lower blood pressure, reduce stress, a multitude of health benefits. So the Center for Mindfulness, a new center, which I'm not extensively involved with, but there is a Center for Contemplative Practice, which is across grounds, and it looks at Eastern forms of healing and philosophy, and that is just something very recently that has started. And within the School of Medicine, there's a tiny thread in the curriculum that's dedicated to integrative medicine and complementary and alternative methods. But I think it's very important. I think going to where the doctors learn is very important to do. And I'll add another thing that I didn't get a lot of in medical school that makes all the difference, and that's nutrition. Hippocrates said, let your food be your medicine and let your medicine be your food. But I didn't learn much about nutrition. That's something that I've taken it on my own to learn about so that I can teach patients that, you know, things that they can do with their diet so that I can do that, so that I have that knowledge and can talk with them as opposed to giving them another appointment to schedule with someone else just to talk about what you eat.
Before we demonize the pharmaceutical industry, I'd like to recall that every industry is subject to lobbying. Food industry, fossil fuels, I mean, we've all seen this sort of practice. And the networks are only too happy to have the additional revenue from the pharmaceutical companies. The ultimate decision on what prescriptions to prescribe for a patient is the physician's. I think they shouldn't succumb to a patient's demanding a particular prescription because they saw it on television, and the balancing information is available for the person watching the commercial. They're responsible for that as well as for the benefits. So I think it needs to be presented in balance. And think of the benefits that have been given by the pharmaceutical industry, by drugs that patients can take to relieve illness and sickness and symptoms and so on, over years of time. Thank you.
You're absolutely right. And the purpose is certainly not to demonize the pharmaceutical industry. So that was certainly not my intent. And I think that there definitely has to be balance there. My personal feeling is that it's a little too far over. And what happens now in systems, not only are doctors being forced to cut the time that they have with their patients, but they also have to respond to what we call patient satisfaction scores. And doctors are likely to be scored lower if they're not giving the patients what the patient thinks that they need. And to have a conversation, the most common example from the physician perspective, the person who comes in with the common cold, a virus, who's demanding antibiotics, and they're insisting that the last time I had this, Dr. X gave me antibiotics and I got better. And to try to say, well, do you know that that was your own natural body healing you? That was not the antibiotic, because the antibiotic will not cure a virus. That was your natural healing mechanism. Give your body a little more time. And then some doctors it's just so much easier to write the prescription and let them go, because to have that conversation takes away from the 10 minutes that they only have in the first place, and they have to get to the next patient. So that's one way that it really impacts the satisfaction scores, and doctors are held responsible for those.
Hello. Yeah, Dr. Ross, how is Obamacare going to affect us seniors?
How is Obamacare going to affect the seniors? Well, I would have to yield to someone with some expertise on how it's going to affect seniors. I think it has yet to be seen, but the claim is that it's going to make access to care easier for seniors. It's going to take away some of the barriers to care that seniors have, and it's going to make some changes in prescription drugs available to seniors and cost and so on and so forth. Now, that is the claim, but I have to sit right here with you and say that we have to wait and see how it's actually going to play out.
I don't think they're going to get any Nobel Prizes for Cialis or Viagra or testosterone or anything. They're just trying to sell products for money. In the Affordable Care Act, I heard that, and we've in a presentation here, that there is money set aside for pilot programs on using preventive care, wellness care, as a criterion for reimbursing doctors, so that it would be keeping patients healthy rather than simply treating as many sick people as possible, that would determine the compensation to go to the medical profession and the medical field. Have you heard of any pilot programs being developed to do that here?
I have not heard of any pilot programs that are working to be developed within the health system that I'm in. That doesn't mean that they're not happening. I know that this is going to be a big reimbursement issue for all facilities, so I do believe that something is happening. Like I said, I have several meetings that are lined up so that, you know, being a doctor who's also going to be subject to this, I'm working to learn about that. But we do know that reimbursement rates are going to change when patients have to come back again to be treated for the same condition, or things that are done that are not focused on the preventive aspect of medicine. So I do believe it's definitely happening. I just can't give you the details about what they're doing.
Hi, Dr. Ross.
Hi.
I'm a retired pharmacist. Do you think that and I agree about the drug companies, do you think that the Affordable Care Act will urge or enforce or whatever, persuade the disparity in between two hospitals to be lessened? I watched a documentary back in the spring. It probably was on Need to Know on PBS. But it compared, I believe, hospital in Salt Lake and hospital in Southern California, and the disparity between the treatment costs for the exact same disease state were astronomically different. And I wonder if you feel like ACA is going to have any effect whatsoever in helping to heal that.
I think there is definitely the potential for the Affordable Care Act to do that. I think that cost systems, cost structures are going to be looked at very carefully, and there probably will be a leveling of the field when it comes to matters of reimbursement, testing, and actual workups that patients go through. So I think it will bring some change in that.
What good words do you say, old people like me, taking a dozen medications, who want to dig in their heels and say, I don't want to take that anymore, I'd rather do something else, I'd take more of it, or I don't ask for it, I don't want it.
I understand. I understand. And I think that, you know, as a part of, you know, I'm a physician, but I consider myself a healer. And as a part of that, I think that we doctors, and I say we need to listen more. We need to listen more. We've got all the evidence that tells us what's really good and what really works, but sometimes we're imposing that evidence on a situation where that's not what the person wants. That's not what the person desires. And I think the optimal healthcare, the optimal healing experience is that you're in charge of your health. And my goal, and I say this to a lot of patients now, you're a grown person. This is what I understand about why this is useful for you. And it's completely your choice not to do it. And these are some other things. One of the things that I commonly recommend is breathing, different types of breath work, breathing exercises and meditation. There's evidence to support it. And I'll tell patients this, listen, try this. Try it. It doesn't cost you anything. It's not associated with side effects. And it may bring you a benefit, but it's something simple like breathing. Now imagine if we spent time doing more of that. Boy, that would put a lot of pharmaceutical companies out of business potentially. Not to say that you don't need. There are drugs that we need. There are pharmaceutical drugs that do help. But I do hear your your frustration. And I would just go in and tell your doctor, listen to me. What are some of my other options? Or take some options that you're interested in and have your doctor have a discussion with you. That's the type of dialogue that we need to get back to, the healing dialogue between doctors and patients.
It's my turn. I just want to say to this gentleman, my mother just celebrated her 96th birthday, and exactly 10 years ago, she said to her doctor, I am not taking any more pills. She takes no pills, and she's in better shape than I am. So there you are. That's okay, right. But my question to you is, there definitely is only one Dr. Pamela Ross. That's real clear. But do you have colleagues that you are on the same page as you are? Are there other physicians, at least in our community, who share your perceptions and your hopes and dreams?
There are. There are a ton of heroes, a ton of champions that are walking the city, working at the University of Virginia, working at other healthcare facilities here. As opposed to taking the chance of naming a whole bunch of people and leaving someone off, I think that it's important to just simply ask a question, are any of your doctors involved or knowledgeable in the area of integrative medicine, in the area of integrative medicine? And that will open the path to who has those interests and can kind of get you to the like-minded spirits in that realm.
Just in general, Obama plan, Obamacare will eventually insure 30 million more people. Meanwhile, some of us are not going to live that long to see all the benefits that are supposed to be coming. I believe in the plan. However, recently, I only get sick on weekends and on Saturday and on holidays. It was a Saturday, and I felt bad. The womb was spinning around. I was dizzy, so I called my doctor's office and got a phone number, and they said, "Call this number, and ask for the geriatrician on call." So I did. First, they put me on hold for about 10 minutes, and then they said, "Leave your number, and we'll call you back." I won't mention the hospital, but they haven't called me back yet. Then I decided I wanted to make an appointment with a pain clinic where I had been before. They knew me. I was on record. Just want to make an appointment. The first four calls, I got a machine. The fifth call, I got a human being. I was elated. And she said, I know what you're trying to do. I would love to help you, but you have to talk to Emily. And she's not here today. Here's her number. I have since called her at least six times, never called me back. This is the same hospital. I'm not telling you which one. Then I was told that the best thing for me would be to switch and get a new primary care physician. So I was told by my ex-nurse, who I'd known for 10 years and trusted, she said, this doctor that you're talking about is my doctor. He's fantastic. And then the man who sold me the policy said the same thing. He's my doctor. You've got to go to him. So I went and made an appointment. I said, I just want to come in for 3 minutes. I just want to meet you. I didn't want to buy a pick and a poke. And when I went in, I made the appointment, everything, they said, they wouldn't let me buy the desk. They said, this doctor is no longer accepting Medicare patients. So then I went, by blind faith, I went to another doctor, and he would only make an appointment with me about 3.5 months in advance. And I objected, and I called, and I said, I need to see a doctor before 3.5 months. So I got another one by chance, and she seems to be very good. But if we're going to insure 30 million more people, we are going to need a lot more doctors. And meanwhile, the 10 minutes that each doctor can give a patient is probably going to be reduced to 6.5 or less. So the interim period is the difficult period, and I probably won't live long enough to see the major benefits of this plan.
Well, I hope that you will. And I hear you. I hear your frustration. We share the same frustration. This is a common theme for many people, to call and get an answering machine, to not be heard or not have the access, and then the most tragic of all, to have a form of coverage that no doctor will see. These are the things that they must change. And if the Affordable Care Act cannot accomplish these types of changes promptly, that means the work is not done. I'm not here to assert that the Affordable Care Act is the answer or the end-all, be-all. I'm open to say that perhaps it's a step in the right direction. The strategies for dealing with the increase, the load that potentially will come from more people being insured is the use of extended providers. So perhaps a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant or some other extended practitioner who can help get people in the system. Now, that's one of the strategies that I've heard. There's no way to get more doctors into the system. You know, we're on a cycle. Takes us 15, 20 years to do all of our training. So, you know, they've got to work on both ends of it, making it possible for more doctors to get in. But I hear you, and I'm optimistic, and give that feedback and let me know, what can I do as a physician to speak up for what you think is important?
So I usually do not speak, but I will. You brought up physician extenders, which I think is a wonder. I am a nurse practitioner. I work in a small select population, but I think for routine care, preventative medicine, I think as a profession we do offer a lot for that. And when we are unable to care for a patient for whatever that purpose is, the extremeness of the condition or the surgery, which we don't do, I think that's where physicians have an incredible role, because you do have all that training. And I work with physicians in my practice, and we work really well together. But like a nurse practitioner or PA can certainly do a lot of regular care, maintenance care, education, and that does free the physician up to do the specialty care that they so need to do. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for doing what you do.
We'll keep you here all day if you're willing to stay. One little quick comment. If there was somebody to answer each and every phone call that came in at the moment it came in, what do you think the costs would be? I mean, there is that. But I do think that the whole purpose of the change is to have more preventative medicine and to have the use of nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and to make sure that everybody goes in for the regular physicals that they are supposed to have, that will ultimately change it all. But it's not going to happen overnight.
Absolutely right. Can I just say how much I love and enjoy and appreciate the wisdom in this room? I just thank you.
If you were back doing your residency and know what you know now, what would you specialize in?
If I could have a system that was supportive, I would have specialized in primary care. I would have done that. But what I am doing is I've taken my passion for emergency medicine and I extend it by doing other things. But that's a very good question. You know, it's a tough question when you're looking at $150,000 of debt and you're looking at the average salaries of the different specialties. But primary care is what we need. And primary care is what I'll try to do, even if it's a matter of just going to groups and talking about health and teaching people healthy way to live.
I'm sorry, I'll make this quick, but it's relative to physicians' pay. We're all old enough to remember when physicians were extremely well paid, and I'm of the opinion that doctors today don't make anywhere near the money that we think they do. Would you just comment on that?
You are absolutely correct. And I think a part of that is related to you know, there's a debt portion, and then physicians have a great deal of certifications and board exams and all manner of certifications and education that they have to keep up, and there's that cost. And physicians are having to, you know, the reimbursement rates are lower. Every year, Medicare, Medicaid, they take a portion out of what the physicians get, and physicians try to band together. No, don't drop it another 12 cents. You know, don't do it. But that's absolutely right. Not as wealthy as we used to be, perhaps in comparison. But when you compare to the general population, physicians still do well. So I'm not trying to be a physician standing before you saying, oh, we're so poor. But relative, we're still doing well.
You mentioned you originally wanted to be a psychiatrist. And today, we have an epidemic of mental health problems. What is the University of Virginia doing about these things? How are you approaching them? How are the future ideas affecting them?
That's a very good question. And let me just clarify, I'm standing before you today speaking as Dr. Pamela Ross, so I will not have all of the University of Virginia's perspectives, but I do appreciate what you're saying. Basically, what I can tell you that I see from my day-to-day practice is we're working to implement more services. I think mental health, it's kind of one, it's again where the reimbursement has fallen off. It's harder to get patients connected to the care that they need. It's hard to get patients the medications that they need. And so what I see is the development of a lot of extra services. We've incorporate the assistance of social workers. We incorporate the assistance of mental health counselors. We have people available on standby in the emergency department essentially 24 hours a day to help us pull people into the system and get them where they need to be. And on the other end of that,
I think it's very important. What the health profession maybe does not do enough of is to look on the preventive end of that. We know that there are certain mental health conditions that have been tied to the diet of people. There are certain, you know, certain preventive things that help with mental health. I talked earlier about breathing exercises and things that can reduce anxiety. We talked about meditation. We've talked about acupuncture. I think that there are a realm of other modalities that we could perhaps start to teach. And in the movie Escape Fire, The Fight to Rescue American Healthcare, you will meet a character who suffers from severe drug addiction and the types of preventive things that were implemented where he didn't require drugs and he didn't require hospitalization. So I think that's the way to move. And based on the things that are being developed, my understanding of things that are being developed at the University of Virginia, we're moving. We're moving in that direction.
I want to take you back to your primary specialty here. A lot of us in the room are grandparents. What are you seeing in the emergency department and with your pediatric specialty that we should be aware of? What can we do as grandparents, assuming we have some contact with our grandchildren, you know, to keep them out of the emergency room?
I think primary, I would say injury prevention, you know, safety, as much as can be done to minimize accidents at home, at school, things of that nature. That's by far probably the most common thing that happens. You know, the simple things, make sure the children are in their car seats. Make sure that your little bike riders or new bicycle riders are wearing their helmets and their knee pads, and teach the children safety. I would say that's probably the main thing, because that's what we see the most of. And then if you have any influence over the diet or what the child is eating, get them away from the sugary drinks, get them away from the candy, get them away from high glycemic index carbohydrates, those carbohydrates that cause the blood sugar to rise very rapidly, because, you know, a candy bar a day, a soda a day, over the course of 25 years results in heart attacks when they're in their 30s. So if you have any influence over their diet, keep it healthy. Whole fruits and vegetables, as many colors as possible, whole grains, brown rice, quinoa, all, you know, the whole grains, lots of water. Try to encourage them to eat in that fashion. Try to help put those habits down. Thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.